Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of Last Christian. Normally, this would be the Bible teaching program, but we have an extra special event for you today. This is one of my favorite teachers, and I'm going to say he's the second smartest person I know on the planet, because his wife, Sharon, is probably the first. So, JD, are you excited about our guest, Mr. Derek Gilbert?
Oh, I am more than excited, and that's the reason I put him on the screen right away for you there, David. I am more than excited. But I know you know this guy really good. I only met him in April at the prophetic conference there in Dallas, Texas, and haven't had the opportunity to interview him yet, and I'm really looking forward to this. Derek Gilbert's the co-host of Unraveling Revelation and PID Radio. You're going to have to tell me what PID is, okay? I didn't research that deep on it, okay? Now, he does that show with his wife, Sharon. He's also the host of 5 and 10 or Skywatch TV. He's an accomplished author, and I'm going to show you a bunch of books for this guy. I mean, he's got, like, 12, I believe. That counts the one that is coming out, what, next month, I think. He also is a part, well, he is the owner, operator of Gilbert House Ministries, along with his wife. And I got a bunch of stuff I'm putting down there. If you guys are watching this on video, then down in the description segment, I'm going to have all kinds of links to where you guys can go find out more about him and about his ministry. And today, we are really lucky because with everything that's going on right now in the world, Derek, with Israel, this is a timely subject. Because now, I'm going to ask you a question right off top, then I'm going to let you guys go, okay? And that is, did the prophetic clock to the rapture and everything that follows that start when Israel returned home?
And with that, I don't know if the clock started then.
Go ahead.
I don't know if the clock started then. By the way, the PID stands in for peering into darkness, which is what Sharon and I have been doing since 2005. So we're trying to be watchmen on the walls, watch persons on the walls, whatever. Certainly one of the mile markers on this highway to the end of the age was the restoration of Israel on May 14th of 1948. What really has surprised me over the last 9 months, 10 months, is as today we're recording this on day 299 of the war between Israel and Hamas.
Right.
Until this war, I could not have imagined a scenario that would bring the whole world against Israel, which is what we see in end times prophecies in the Old Testament, Ezekiel 38 and 39, Zechariah 12, Zechariah 14, the whole world comes against Israel.
Right.
And in Ezekiel 38, there's a reference there to a hook in the jaw that brings Gog of Magog, which is the Old Testament conception of the Antichrist, to Israel to do battle with those who are left in the land. And there's been speculation for years about what is that hook in the jaw? Does Israel discover a whole bunch of oil or natural gas or something? I think it's going to be something like what we're seeing right now. I mean, Israel could discover just tons of gas and never have as much as Russia, not even anywhere near. Could discover huge oil deposits in the Eastern Mediterranean and still not have anything close to what Saudi Arabia, Russia, or the United States, or Venezuela have in proven reserves. So I don't think that's it. I think it'll be something like what we're seeing right now, where Israel is at war with its neighbors. The world says, you're committing crimes against humanity, war crimes, and we're going to put a stop to this because you won't stop doing battle with these neighbors of yours. You're killing all these poor children and your colonizers, and your. I think what we're seeing with the protests in the West, with the pro-Hamas protest and so many of our college campuses and major cities, is the seed that will eventually blossom into that evil fruit with the Antichrist, a dynamic geopolitical leader, religious leader, leading the world to war against Israel. So that was what prompted me to put together a presentation for the Go Therefore conference in suburban Dayton this past weekend. Okay. Dr. Mike Spaulding, who has also written extensively about the return of Israel to the land, he and I were talking a couple of months back, and I'd been reading a book that I found very enlightening called The Secret War Against the Jews, which was published in 1994. The authors John Loftus former Department of Justice prosecutor, and Mark Ahrens, a journalist from Australia, who partnered and have done some just incredible work on exposing the connections between Western intelligence from the 20s through, well, the 90s when the book was published, and the Arabs, and basically showed how Western intelligence, MI6 and the CIA principally, worked to try to prevent Israel from coming into being, and then worked against the nation of Israel, working in concert with the Arabs to try to destroy the state of Israel. So the conspiracy theories that have been floated about the creation of Israel, that Israel was a state created by the Rothschilds, by the Vatican, by the Freemasons, by the Illuminati, whatever, they just don't hold up when you start digging into actual history.
That's where I really wanted to go, because there is a lot of talk about that, and sadly, even among Christians. And it's seemed weird to me that, oh yeah, it's the ones who claim they're Jews and they're not, but it was exactly to the day of the prophesied return of Israel to, you know, its land. But somehow it's not them, and you're really going to clear that up for us today, and that's going to be amazing, well, people.
Again, what Mike Spaulding wrote recently for the website Harbingers Daily was a wonderful article titled, "No, God Did Not Say There Would Be a Fake Israel." There are many Christians who are claiming now that Israel is not the real Israel because they're not following God's commands, and they're this or they're that. And besides, if you read what the Talmud has written about Jesus, and look, the Jews do not accept Jesus as the Messiah, but neither does most of the world. Why would you? When Satan took Jesus up a very high mountain, which in all probability was Mount Hermon, which should be relevant to some of your viewers and listeners, he promised them all the nations of the world if he would just bow the knee to Satan, and Jesus refused, of course. Mm-hmm. That includes Israel. That includes the United States.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Satan said all of these have been given to him, and he could give them to whoever he will. So I don't understand this attempt to explain away the modern state of Israel as somehow not holy enough to be of God. And oh, by the way, the Jews aren't real Jews anyway. They're Khazarians. They're Turks from Central Asia, modern day Ukraine, basically.
Yeah.
No serious historian puts any stock in that theory, and DNA research has debunked it to boot. But even if it was true, if the Ashkenazi Jews of Europe were Khazarian in origin, who cares? Jesus had Canaanite or Amorite through Rahab in his bloodline. He had Moabite through Ruth in his bloodline. Does that make Jesus not a Jew? It makes no sense.
Right.
These are efforts to try to explain away support to justify anti-Jewish, anti-Semitic feelings and sentiment and policies on the part of Christians. And they just don't hold water in my view. But the history of how Israel came to be, I think, really debunks the idea that it somehow was the Jewish banking cabal, the Rothschilds, mm-hmm. or other secret societies who put this together.
I want to really get into that with you, but I've got a question off the top, and if I don't ask it, I'll forget it. I mentioned this on our last show, and David was unfamiliar with these people, but the Hezbollah attack over this past weekend was on the Golan Heights. And my understanding of this is that there's a community there of Druze. That's what they call themselves, Druze. Mm-hmm. And they're not Israelites per se, but they do not adhere to the Islamic teachings, and they're supportive of Israel and that kind of thing. That's my understanding of it, but that's about all I know, Derek. Can you kind of expand on that a little bit?
The Druze are sort of like the Kurds in that they don't really fit into a neat little peg. They're a peg that doesn't fit into a neat hole.
Okay.
They are now the Kurds are Sunni Muslims, but ethnically they're not Persian, they're not Arab, mm-hmm. they're not Turk, and so they're the only major ethnic group that came out of World War I without its own country. The Kurds really got shafted. Okay. The Druze are mainly Arab, but they're split between Syria, Israel, and Lebanon.
Okay.
They are an offshoot of Shia Islam, but they do not consider themselves Muslims. They venerate as their first prophet Jethro, the father-in-law of Moses.
Right.
Their actual beliefs are somewhat secretive. You really have to be a member of the community to understand, to really be exposed to their teachings. But they are known to be loyal citizens of whatever country they belong to. So if they're in Syria, they're loyal to Assad. If they're in Lebanon, they're Lebanese. If they're in Israel, many of their young men join the IDF and serve faithfully in the IDF. So they are considered very good citizens, good neighbors to have. When we've been to Israel back in 2018 and 19, we ate in Druze communities on the Golan. Ate at a Druze restaurant. So they're not strange. They're not weird. They're just, they've got their own religion, but they are good citizens, good people to have around. And the Israelis consider them Israeli.
Okay.
So since we've seen that attack on the soccer field on Saturday, you know, the number two man in Hezbollah has been taken out and the number one man in Hamas has been taken out.
Yeah. Well, so, I'm going to get into that right now.
And that was in Tehran. So the Israelis are really...
I'm going to break in on you on that one because this is a news show. I am a member of the U.S. Press Association. David is too. He just hasn't got his credentials yet. But anyway... I do want to play that because that is the new deal right now. Let's listen to this one right here.
In a move that is expected to significantly ramp up regional tensions, Hamas says its political leader Ismail Haniyeh was assassinated in Iran and has blamed Tel Aviv for his death. Israel is yet to comment but said it was holding a situational assessment. Hamas called Haniyeh's death a, quote, cowardly act that will not go unpunished. Sarah Coates has the latest from Tel Aviv.
Still no word from the Israelis on this assassination of the head of Hamas's Politburo, Ismail Haniyeh. But certainly it is a very, very fragile time in the region. We've also heard from the US Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin. He's been speaking, saying that if Israel were to be attacked, then the United States would defend Israel. So certainly, as I said, a very fragile time on the ground. We do know that the Israelis are right now holding a situational assessment, and there will be many, many meetings taking place over the next few hours as people continue to gather more information on this. Now, we do know that Haniyeh was killed in Tehran. He was in Iran visiting for the inauguration of the new Iranian president.
Okay, so Israel hit in, I'm assuming it's Israel that did this, because they're not denying it. I mean, they haven't said to do it, but, you know, they're not denying it. They hit in Tehran, Iran. I mean, you know, so they know where these terrorists are at, and good word for terrorists right here. If you are a terrorist and still alive, your best hope is to raise a white flag, turn yourself in, and they might not kill you. But if you don't, they will. Okay, end of story. All right, Derek, with that, sir, I'm going to turn it back over to you, and you just take us wherever you want to go.
Well, again, the history of how Israel came to be in 1948 is not well understood by many of us Christians. We assume that Israel came in and stole the land, or at least that's what we've been told by many in the media, liberal pundits, have this assumption that Israel came in and through force of arms took the land away from the native Palestinians. We need to understand, first of all, the Palestinian is not an ethnicity any more than Canaanite is an ethnicity. It was a rebranding of the Arabs who lived in that region in the 1960s, suggested by the KGB, adopted by Yasser Arafat and the PLO rebrand the long simmering Arab Zionist conflict as Israeli-Palestinian to made it sound like the Palestinians had some ownership to the land. The fact is there's never been an independent Palestine. The Arabs who were living in the land in 1948 had been subjects of the Ottoman Empire for almost 400 years. Prior to that, they were under a succession of Muslim leaders over the centuries. Nobody ever stops to ask, wait a minute, if the Israelis are colonizers, where did the Arabs come from? How did they get from Arabia to take over Iraq and Syria and North Africa and so on? So understand that the Arabs are colonizers in the land that is now occupied by Israel and the so-called Palestinians. Zionists, Arab, or rather Jewish immigrants started coming to Palestine in the 19th century as it became obvious over the course of the 19th century that they were not safe in Europe. There were or North Africa or Russia or even North America. There were a series of events, and I cherry-picked several. I'll just do a couple here just to show that while there were those who managed to integrate themselves into the upper levels of European society, like the Rothschilds, there's no question. They were very, very wealthy, and they had branches of the family in Germany, France, Spain, England, the later United Kingdom. So they were more or less assimilated into European society. But even with that, in 1815, for example, Pope Pius VII reinstituted or reestablished the Jewish ghetto that had existed in Rome up until 1808 when Napoleon conquered Italy. And he said, this isn't right. Let's do away with the ghetto Jews. You can live wherever you want. You can work at whatever career you want, which had not been the case until his conquest. But after 1815, when Napoleon was defeated at Waterloo and was basically sent to exile, Jews had to return, under the orders of Pope Pius VII, had to return to the ghetto, where the doors to the walls of the ghetto were closed at night. You didn't want to be a Jew caught outside the ghetto after dark. This, you know, was a surprise to me. And that ghetto, by the way, continued until 1870. It wasn't finally done away with for good until 1870. I thought the Jewish ghetto was something the Nazis invented, you know, yeah, for Warsaw too. And me other too. European yeah. cities, World War II. No, there were ghettos in Europe. And one of the most notorious was the ghetto in Rome. And again, it was done at the institution and of the Vatican and enforced by the Vatican. There were anti-Jewish riots in Germany in 1819, August to October of 1819. These were called the Hep riots. Nobody's really sure where the Hep comes from. Some think it has to do with the call of shepherds, you know, trying to round up the sheep, you know, Hep. But there are some who think it's an acronym for Hierosolyma et Perdita, which means in Latin, Jerusalem is lost.
Oh, okay.
What is probable is that this is the origin of the cheer, hip, hip, hooray. The hep, anti-Jewish hep riots in Germany, Austria, and Latvia, Denmark as well, in 1819. Beginning in 1827, Jewish boys as young as 8 were could be forcibly conscripted into the Russian army, where they were either encouraged and sometimes forced to be baptized. In 1840, there was the Damascus Affair, where a Christian monk and his Muslim servant went missing and turned up dead. Jews were blamed for it because it was claimed, this was the old blood libel, they used their blood to bake their matzah. And so Jews and Muslims, or Christians and Muslims, rose up and committed acts of violence throughout Damascus in against Jews. 1844, Karl Marx published a piece called On the Jewish Question, Karl Marx, Marxism, Communism. He wrote, and I quote, "What is the worldly cult of the Jew? Huckstering. What is the worldly god? Money. Money is the jealous god of Israel, besides which no other god may exist. The god of the Jews has been secularized and has become the god of this world. In the final analysis, the emancipation of the Jews, which is something that Jews have been trying to acquire in Russia, the right to live and work wherever they wanted, the emancipation of the Jews is the emancipation of mankind from Judaism." End quote. In other words, anti-sentiment or Jew hatred is literally Marxist. In 1862, here in the United States, General Ulysses S. Grant issued General Order Number 11. This was in December of 1862, ordering all Jews out of his military district. That was parts of Tennessee, Mississippi, and Kentucky.
Wow.
You see, cotton from the South, which was very important to the global economy at that point, the South provided most of the world's cotton. It was embargoed. The North would not allow the South to sell its cotton. Well, Ulysses' father had a couple of Jewish friends, merchants from Cincinnati, and he thought he could introduce them to his son Ulysses and have them perhaps, find a couple of boatloads of cotton that they could sell in the North, and Ulysses' father would get a cut of the action, you know, a piece of the action. Well, Ulysses was very upset. General Grant ordered them out of his office, but then he ordered all the Jews out of his military district. He blamed all the Jews for these two guys and his dad. This generated a lot of pushback in Congress. And a few weeks later, when President Lincoln found out about it, he forced Grant to rescind the order and apologize. So, but again, anti-Jewish sentiment was here in the United States as well. 1871, Pope Pius IX said this about Jews, quote, "Of these dogs, there are too many of them at present in Rome, and we hear them howling in the streets, and they are disturbing us in all places," end quote. That's the Pope. 1881 to 1884, pogroms in Russia, large-scale targeted anti-Jewish riots, more than 200 events, triggered by the assassination of Tsar Alexander II in 1881. One of the conspirators was a woman who had some Jewish ancestry. Her role in the plot was blown out of proportion to justify then saying, it's all the Jews. The Jews are responsible for the murder of Alexander II. And so suddenly 200 anti-Jewish events in 166 towns, including cities like Kyiv, Warsaw, Odessa, thousands of Jewish homes destroyed during these riots. Tsar Alexander III, the second's successor, obviously, in 1882 enacted a series of temporary laws aimed at discriminating against the Jews. One of his advisors said that these laws were meant to, and I quote now, cause one-third of the Jews to emigrate, one-third to accept baptism, and one-third to starve.
Ah, oh man.
And to that end, wow, in 1891,
one-third.
1891, 20,000 Jews.
Yep.
20,000 Jews thrown out of Moscow in 1891, so many that the Muslim leaders in Jerusalem appealed to Ottoman authorities in Istanbul to prohibit the entry of Jews trying to flee Russia. It was about this time that a lot of Jews fleeing Russia were going to places like England and winding up in the East End. In fact, during the Jack the Ripper killings, 1889, there was a piece of graffiti that was written on the wall there: "The Jews will not be blamed for nothing." So, this led to an event in 1894. It was followed by an event in 1894 called the Dreyfus Affair, where a French artillery captain was falsely accused of spying for the Germans. He was convicted in a show trial and spent 5 years in prison at hard labor on Devil's Island, which is the French penal colony off the northern coast of South America, French Guiana. It finally emerged that the real culprit was a French army major named Esterhazy. But when when the military hierarchy, when the military command found out about it, they covered up the evidence, brought new charges against Dreyfus, and found him guilty, convicted him, added another 10 years to his sentence.
Yeah, they just found something else just because.
Sounds normal.
But then they pardoned him.
Yeah.
Sounds normal. Then they pardoned him. It's like, no, okay, we'll let you go, even though we know you're not... you're guilty. We know this is all made up. Just what's really remarkable is
that Dreyfus offered a solution.
But what's really remarkable is that Dreyfus went back into the French military and served through World War One, and eventually retired in the 1930s as a major. So he went back into the military that had conspired to convict him, forced him to spend 5 years, at least 5 years, at hard labor because he was Jewish.
But before you continue here, and you're given a great history lesson, and it's one that everybody needs to learn to see that this isn't new. What's going on in the United States right now with all the protests and all this kind of stuff, and really across the world, this isn't new. This has been going on for centuries. But I want people to see, Derek, that I told them that you're an accomplished author, okay? And I want to show them this right here really quick. Those are his books, okay? I mean, that's pretty impressive if you ask me. And
just the artwork alone is impressive.
It's really incredible. And of course, Derek, you can tell us about any of those books. I know you've got a new one that's coming out really soon, and I want to make certain that everybody sees it, because again, when is it coming out again? And give us a little information.
This will be out. The book is called The Gates of Hell, and I co-authored this with my wife, Sharon, who is the co-host of my life. This will be out in mid-October, and it basically tracks the history of how humanity has tried to contact spirits on the other side of the gates of hell. When Jesus went to Caesarea Philippi and said, "On this rock I will build my ecclesia, my church, my congregation, and the gates of hell," which is this really big cave called the Grotto of Pan right over here, "will not prevail against it." That was just the latest event at his point. But we go back to the prehistoric era and show examples of how people were trying to communicate with spirits of the netherworld, and how in the present day it continues through the transhumanist movement, through consumption of psychedelics, and even the modern UFO and alien contactee abductee phenomenon.
Here we go with all UFOs, right. David. That's a big one for Mr. Paxton there. David, I'm going to let you take us out to the end of the first half here.
We've got a couple minutes here. I want to also tap into, I know you got a ton of stuff you're talking about. I want to open up, some people may not know the complete history of the anti-Semitism. So just on the way out of the first half here, I think anti-Semitism, it's Shem. So Shem, Ham, and Japheth were the three, and basically Abraham was down the Shem line. But there's also, he's got other kids through Keturah. You know, he's got Keturah, he had six kids, and then you have the Edomites with Esau, and then you have Ishmael. And then they all kind of got together because they think they should be part of the birthright too, since Abraham's their father. But that's what the word Arab means, is mixed. So maybe you could touch on that a little bit. And then maybe if you're familiar with this, Deuteronomy 23:7, it says, you know, thou shalt not abhor an Edomite or from Esau, for he is thy brother, and thou shalt not abhor an Egyptian. But Egyptians were Hamites, right? But because there was a stranger in their land. So maybe we could talk about something like that as well. But we have a minute left, and we usually encourage people, it's what Wolverud always said, you know, when you see the Christmas decorations go up, you know, Thanksgiving's around the corner. So we know the rapture is imminent. It has been since, you know, Paul wrote about it, but it's even more imminent now, obviously, 2,000 years later. So if you have not received Christ yet, okay, these things are upon us that we see in the Bible, and they're happening at warp speed at this point. So we encourage you before the rapture, because if you miss the rapture, you can still receive Christ during the tribulation, but it's going to be a little bit chaotic. What do you say, Derek?
Yeah, it is absolutely very close to the end of history. We don't set dates, but we definitely know that the time is growing very close. And again, the restoration of Israel in 1948 was just a big mile marker, you know, exit dead ahead. So now is the time to accept Jesus Christ as Lord and Savior.
Amen. So that's it. So stay tuned. You definitely got to come back and hear the rest of Derek's presentation here. And we'll catch you guys on the flip side. Be right back. Bye.
From Feature Story News in London, I'm Simon Gaitan. A major prisoner exchange between Russia and the West is reportedly underway, with reports suggesting jailed journalist Evan Gerskovich and former US Marine Paul Whelan could be involved in the exchange. At least 9 people have died in New Delhi following torrential rains in the Indian capital. India's meteorological department has issued red alerts across the region, and the government has asked people to not step out unless absolutely necessary. Shiroshi Mukherjee reports.
Heavy rainfall across New Delhi caused severe waterlogging and widespread traffic jams, bringing the city to a standstill. The Delhi government has ordered a shutdown of schools in the city and issued safety advisories for its residents. Government officials say they're monitoring the situation and are keeping a close eye on low-lying areas across the capital. The bad weather also impacted air traffic. At least 10 flights were diverted away from Delhi, and airline companies have warned passengers of the possibility of more flight disruptions. India's weather office says the rains are expected to continue till August 5th. Experts say Delhi's poor drainage infrastructure and rainfall-led structural collapses have led to serious safety concerns in the city. Sriyoshi Mukherjee, New Delhi.
Fears of regional escalation mount as Iran has reportedly discussed retaliation against Israel with its proxies in the Middle East for the assassination of Hamas's political leader Ismail Haniyeh in an airstrike on Wednesday, which it blames on Tel Aviv. Israel is yet to comment on the assassination directly. Thousands turned out in Iran's capital Tehran for the funeral procession of Haniyeh on Thursday. A teenager has been charged with the murder of 3 girls in Southport, northwest England, and appeared at Liverpool City Magistrates Court following a wave of far-right protests linked to the attack. 8 other children and 2 adults were injured in the vicious knife attack on Monday at a Taylor Swift-themed dance class. The 17-year-old suspect was named following the court hearing as Axel Rudakabana after identification restrictions were lifted by the judge in order to avoid the spread of misinformation. Nina Maria Potts has more.
The charges came as Southport mopped up after an outburst of far-right violence that included clashes at a mosque. Protesters were worked up by false claims the attacker was an asylum seeker. There were also clashes near the UK Prime Minister Keir Starmer's residence in London. Manchester was the latest scene of violence overnight. In London, more than 100 people were arrested for offences including violent disorder and an assault on an emergency worker. That was according to London's Metropolitan Police. About 24 children were attending the dance workshop on Monday when the assailant with a knife started attacking. 3 children died from their injuries. The 10 wounded included 5 girls and 2 adults who are in critical condition. Nina Maria Potts, London.
From Bureaus Worldwide, this is FSN.
Hey everybody, welcome back. We are talking about Israel with Mr. Derek Gilbert. And I just wanted to throw this in too, because he has a ton of information and sometimes I get lost in it. but I wanted to talk about real quick, as we get back into this discourse, the reason there's so much animosity towards Israel is because the short story is the devil thinks that if he can thwart God's plan for the third of the remnant Israel to repent and, you know, say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord, then he could win the chess game. So I just want to throw that out there. If you put that in the mix and then Derek will explain why there's so much confusion surrounding Israel. Yeah. So thanks, Derek, for sharing all this. It's going to be amazing.
Yep. Looking forward to it. Go ahead.
Well, we left off with the Dreyfus affair, 1896. Mm-hmm. Dreyfus was not pardoned until about 1906, but his trial was covered by a journalist by the name of Theodore Herzl, who is best known as the father of modern political Zionism. Educated, multilingual, he covered the Dreyfus affair for his publication and was convinced, based on what he heard in the courtroom, that Dreyfus was guilty. But as evidence came out over the years, again in 1899, the new trial with more fake evidence, it became obvious that Dreyfus was framed, had been framed, and had been sentenced to 5 years on this terrible penal colony, Devil's Island. So Herzl began to realize that that Europe, despite the fact that Jews had, many of them had become educated, had assimilated into society, were not safe. Because until his trial, Dreyfus had been, he was a captain, artillery captain. He was a respected soldier who was accused because somebody knew something had gone on and they needed a patsy. Mm-hmm. So who better to blame than one of the Jews?
Right.
So this motivated Herzl to form the Zionist organization, the first World Zionist Congress. The World Zionist organization continues to this day, by the way. First meeting was held in August of 1897. Ooh. So, His goals were to promote Jewish immigration to Palestine. He basically said, look, we can assimilate all we want. We've been assimilating since the second century after Jews were basically shipped out of Judea by the Emperor Hadrian after the Bar Kokhba Rebellion, which ended around 135 AD. So yeah, they had been assimilating, for about 1900 years, 1800 years, and they were still not safe. The pogroms in Russia were ongoing at that time. It was clear that there was no safe place in the world, and so he was calling for Jewish immigration to Palestine. He did try to appeal to Jewish nobility in England, which included the Rothschilds, but he didn't get anywhere of these guys. He tried appealing to the bankers in Europe, which included notable members of the Rothschild family. He didn't get anywhere. Mm-hmm. Like prominent Jewish citizens in the United States, they considered these new emigres who were fleeing the persecution in Russia as unwashed, they're uneducated, they're poor, they're dirty, they don't even speak our language, I don't want anything to do with them.
Right.
Herzl's position was, they will be you in a few years if we don't band together and try to protect ourselves. So Herzl didn't have much use for the bankers, and the bankers didn't like him. Baron Edmund Rothschild. Edmund Rothschild, he was the French line of the family. He did finance and support some of the early kibbutzim in the north of Israel, got those communities started. Baron Albert Rothschild of the Austrian Rothschilds had nothing to do with Jews. Mm. He was, look, I've got mine. Rest, you can find your own way.
Yeah.
As far as I know, by the way, the only prominent Rothschild to be buried in Israel is Edmund.
Okay.
And as far as I know, none of the prominent Rothschilds to this day actually live in Israel. So the idea that the Rothschilds were intimately connected with the formation of Israel, it just seems a little odd that once they got this new country that they bought and paid for, that none of them would move there.
Right. Yeah.
That doesn't make a lot of sense to me. Yeah. Anyway.
The big narrative is they just spent all their money and they bought it and they put them in there. So
right.
I'm just saying that clearly not the case.
The evidence does not support that, no.
Mm-hmm.
So in fact, when you get into the 20th century, yeah, when you get into the 20th century, you find that the Rothschilds actually, their fortunes took a beating between World War I and World War II, the Great Depression, but also the fact that they were Jews. And suddenly all the money to be made beginning in the 1920s and 30s was in Arabia and in Germany. And the ruling elites in neither of those places was, say, favorably disposed to the Jews. In 1985, Fortune magazine ran a list of its 100 wealthiest people on earth, and there wasn't a single Rothschild on the list.
And that was in what year now? Did you say 1945?
1985.
Okay.
Their fortunes took a beating in the first half of the 20th century, but by 85, they still were not among the 100. Don't shed tears for the Rothschilds. They're still rich our standards, but they're not at that elite level.
Yeah, I'll take a little bit myself.
Yeah. They're not at that elite level that you would have to be at to actually buy your own country.
Yeah.
So anyway, Herzl went to the Vatican, tried to get Pope Pius X, to support. Pius X said, nope, since the Jews had refused to recognize Jesus as Messiah, the Roman Catholic Church, Christ's vicar on earth, could not recognize them. Mm. Nice. Mm-hmm. Herzl died in 1904, but again, World Zionist Organization continues to this day. Now, here's the thing. The next major event on the calendar we've probably all heard of, the Balfour Declaration, which came out in 1917. Mm-hmm. And we've got this idea that Lord Balfour, the Foreign Secretary for the United Kingdom, just wrote this letter and delivered it to a Rothschild, which is true. He gave it to Walter Rothschild of the Jewish family, that branch that was in England. Mm-hmm. But that's all Rothschild did with it. He received it on behalf of the Jewish community.
Yeah.
But what it did was it declared Britain's support or a national home for the Jews in Palestine. That was in November of 1917. But this was not written in a vacuum, okay? And there were other documents that preceded it. For example, 1916, the Sykes-Picot Agreement, which was a secret treaty between the U.S. and France. Basically, they were deciding how they were going to divide up the Ottoman Empire's territories in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. Everything from the Mediterranean to the Persian Gulf. They were going to figure out who was going to get what. In June of 1917, there was a letter from the French Foreign Minister, Jules Cambon, to a man named Nahum Sokolov. Sokolov was essentially the successor to Theodor Herzl. Okay. He was another educated man, multilingual. He had a gift for diplomacy. And what the French Foreign Minister wrote to Sokolov while he was shuttling back and forth between England and France and Italy and the Vatican and the United States, trying to drum up some consensus for the allies of World War I, the US, the UK, France, Italy, Japan, for when the war was over, remembering that the Ottoman Empire was the allies of Germany and Austria-Hungary in the war, that after the war was over, could we please have a world consensus from the Allies, or at least a consensus among the Allies, that the Jews, Zionists, would get an independent homeland in Palestine?
Hang on one second. I got a question, and David knows I do this.
He interrupts me constantly, so don't
all
worry
the
about
time.
It.
Yeah, Germany. You've mentioned a couple of times, and we know what happened there in the Holocaust. But was that like a primary destination for Jews back then?
Well, back in the Middle Ages, as they fled the Middle East, So yeah, there were Jews that had been living in Eastern Germany and what is now Eastern Germany and Poland, Ukraine, Russia, since for 1,000 years, basically. After the diaspora in the 2nd century AD, Jews spread out over all of the Mediterranean world and then into what is now Europe and Western Europe. So they've been there for a very, very long time, but okay. always treated as essentially second-class citizens.
I was just wondering if that was like one of the big destinations for them, because so many were killed there. I don't know how many were here in the United States or anywhere else, but I come up with crazy questions every now and then. That's one of them.
Oh, I even got a better one. But
The Secretary of State of the Confederacy during the Civil War, the Confederacy, the Southern states of America, the Secretary of State under their president was a man named Judah Benjamin.
Okay.
You can't get more Jewish of a name than Judah Benjamin.
Right. No, you can't.
So, but yet, Southerners are supposed to be very anti-Semitic. Anyway,
and we're not. I'm a Southerner, and we're not. I love Israel.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's why I laugh when we hear today the accusations that conservative Christians are anti-Semitic. Yeah. There are too many who are, but for the most part, and many Orthodox Jews know this, that conservative American Christians are Israel's best friend in the world. And they understand that.
I know in New York.
Anyway.
More Jews here in New York City than even in Israel. So, yeah, it's pretty big here. I want to throw another monkey wrench in there, too. Maybe you can keep track of this. But I couldn't help but notice, the Colombo, the Jubilee cycle. Now, bear with me. I know you could follow me on this because you do that very well. When I go off on these tangents sometimes. But you have, always prophetically, you have bigger pictures. You got the outer courts, the inner courts, and the Holy of Holies. You have three separate layers of prophetic fulfillment in types and patterns. And given the Jubilee year, I don't know if there's a coincidence or if it's actually on a Jubilee, but 1917, when it's a Balfour Declaration, when they declared that okay, Israel could be cool. And it wasn't until 1967, 50 years later, a Jubilee year, that they regained Jerusalem. And then it was in 2017, so again, another 50 years where Jerusalem was declared the capital. And to me, that kind of looks like the outer courts, the inner courts, the Holy of Holy in types and patterns in Jubilee succession. And I think something along these lines, remember our friend who used to teach that the World War II was, with a third of the ships were destroyed, and he used to speak with us. Oh, forget his name. So I'm sorry, I feel so bad. But he used to think, and that's the thing, seems to me like outer courts, inner courts, and Holy of Holies with prophetic fulfillment as well. So I don't know if that fits into what you're talking about today, but I think it would certainly add some flavor to it.
It's the kind of thing that Jonathan Kahn does very well. I really hadn't looked at it. In 2017, we were in Israel. It was actually 2018, May 14th, when the change was made and the first signs went up, said, U.S. Embassy this way in Jerusalem. Mm-hmm.
But well, he declared December 6th, just before that. But then
Right. But it's a very Amerocentric view, because I used to think, because the media will often use Tel Aviv as like a stand-in for the government of Israel. It's the same way as Moscow replied today, or the White House said today, blah blah blah. Tel Aviv said the Jews. When you go to Israel, it's like Jerusalem has always been the capital.
Amen.
Mm. Okay, it didn't take the American president to move the embassy to make Jerusalem Israel's capital. Jerusalem has always, that's where the prime minister lives, that's where the Knesset meets, that's where the Supreme Court is. All of their government offices are there. It's just all these other nations insist on having their embassies in Tel Aviv.
Right.
And the foreign press uses Tel Aviv as a stand-in for the government of Israel. So I do think there's something in the 50-year cycles, especially when you look at what happened last October 7th, which was 50 years and a day, from the Yom Kippur War, right. or, I'm sorry, for the Yeah, from the Yom Kippur War of 1973, which very nearly destroyed Israel. And hopefully we'll get the time to talk about that, because Israel was saved by a very unlikely hero. Spoiler, it was not Henry Kissinger. So the Balfour Declaration, even though it was written by the United Kingdom and the foreign minister there, it was not just the United Kingdom going solo here. Again, they were allies in the war against Germany, Austria-Hungary, and the Ottoman Empire, whose territory was being carved up here with this letter. At least a portion of it was promised. With the agreement of France, France signed on to it. In fact, their foreign minister, a month before the Balfour Declaration, issued his own letter. The Italians signed on to it. The Japanese, who people forget were allies in World War I, even the Vatican. You got a new pope. And the Vatican came on board here. Benedict XV told Sokolov, yes, yes, I believe we shall be good neighbors in Israel. Mm-hmm. Quite a change from the previous popes who had called the Jews dogs and refused to recognize them. Mm-hmm. So, and again, this was due to the work of Nahum Sokolov, who should be more famous than he is. The question, though, is whether the Balfour Declaration, even Woodrow Wilson, by the way, even though he didn't do so publicly at first, Wilson approved of the letter and said, okay, we'll support this. But the letter, again, was to support a national home for Jews in Palestine. Notice, not the national home, and note that it didn't say an independent state. Okay. It was weasel language that allowed the Brits later to say, well, you know, it's a national home. Hey, we've got some land in Uganda. How about going there? They actually offered that to Herzl back in the early part of the 20th century.
Wow.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, and he was going to take it, and the rest of the World Zionist Congress said, "No,
it's not our land." Yeah, that's right. Not it. That's not where we need to be. We need to be in Jerusalem. And you are 100% correct that Jerusalem has been the capital of Israel. And you know, I say this whenever I know I've got a really big audience coming, and I know with you, I'm going to have that. Okay. And I always issue this challenge to anybody that is Muslim or anybody in the with the Islamic faith to find Jerusalem in the Quran. Find it, point it out to me, and then I want you to go and count the number of times that it's in the Bible. And after you run, after you lose count, then it should become obvious to you that the Jews have always. God gave them the land in the book of Genesis, and he promised that when he brings them back, they're not losing it again. Okay, now, I wanted to throw that in there real quick, Derek, and I appreciate it, and I'm going to let you get right back to work.
Since we're on side notes, Yerushalayim means it rains down peace, and it's a plural word, which means there's two of them. I'm looking forward to the new one coming as well.
Amen. Amen. Mm. All right, Derek, now, sorry for the interruption.
It's worth noting that while all of this is going on, the Brits were behind the scenes communicating with the Arabs who lived in what is now Syria and Iraq and Jordan and Arabia, because, again, all of that territory until World War I was under the control of the Turks. So the Brits, through guys like T.E. Lawrence of Arabia, wanted to stir up a rebellion among the Arab tribes. Now, the Brits didn't really think the Arabs were very good fighters. They did know for a fact that the Turks were pretty serious fighters. So they didn't expect much. They thought, okay, maybe this will be a distraction. We'll pull some of the Turkish soldiers away from the European theater. Turned out that they were more successful than they had been, than the Brits had thought. So they were promising, while they were saying to the Jews, the Zionists, yes, we support an independent Jewish state, an independent Jewish home, or a Jewish home in Palestine. They were also telling the Arabs that they were going to support Arab independence. And what Sharif Hussein, who ruled in Mecca, he was the direct linear descendant of Muhammad. This is the Hashemite line, the Hashemite kings. King Abdullah of Jordan, you hear about the Hashemite kingdom of Jordan. Yep. Abdullah is like the great-grandson of Sharif. Sharif Hussein of Mecca. The Brits were trying to convince Hussein that they would set up with him an independent Arabia from Aleppo, which is northern Syria, to Aden, which is the port in Yemen. In other words, everything from Yemen on the Gulf of Aden to the border with Turkey would be one great big independent Arabian state. Well, after World War I, the Arabs really didn't have much use, or the Arabs didn't have much more value to the Brits. So it's like they kept kicking the can down the road. Meanwhile, you've got guys like T.E. Lawrence and another fellow, an MI6 agent who was really rogue, by the name of Jack Philby, who probably did more for the Arabs in terms of getting their independence than T.E. Lawrence did. It's just they never made a movie about Philby of Arabia. Philby.
It doesn't flow as good.
Philby and Lawrence. It doesn't. Philby and Lawrence backed different sheikhs in this, while Lawrence was supporting Sharif Hussein, whose family, the Hashemites, had ruled Mecca for 1,000 years. In 1917, Philby had been sent on a mission by the British Foreign Office to this sheikh who followed the Wahhabist strain of Sunni Islam, which is a very conservative strain. We need to go back and follow Islam the way Muhammad taught it, called Abdulaziz or Ibn Saud, from which we get the name Saudi Arabia. Saudi is not an ethnicity, it's the family name. It would be like calling our country Biden-y America or Trump-y America. So that's why we call it Saudi Arabia. Before 1932, it was just Arabia. But because Philby was working against the British government, he had his own bones to pick with the British government. They'd fired him as a civil servant because of sexual misconduct, which apparently is not an obstacle to advancing your career in the intelligence game. He was brought in by MI6, and he was backing Abdulaziz Ibn Saud, while Lawrence was backing Sharif Hussein. So while T.E. Lawrence was helping the Arabs get their independence from the Turks, Philby was feeding secret British intelligence from MI6 to Ibn Saud that helped him defeat Sharif Hussein and take Mecca. This happened in 1925. So you had that political dynamic going on at the same time.
Okay, I got another off-the-wall question for you, because this is one I hear a lot from people, okay? And so I want to get your take on it, because you're the Israeli expert here. But they tell me that Ishmael is what was where all the descendants came from. Now, you know, down to Muhammad and all that, okay? And is that correct? Mm-hmm.
As far as we can tell, I mean, just as Jews trace their ancestry to Abraham, so do Arabs.
Okay.
All right. And it is interesting that one of Ishmael's sons, Nebaioth, had the same name as the Nabataeans, who ruled around Edom and the region of Petra, even as far north as Damascus during the first century, the time of the apostles. Okay. There's another descendant, his name was Kedar, you know, the Kedarites, Q-E-D-A-R, the Kedarites, mentioned in the Old Testament a couple places. Right. Mm-hmm. That's just Qatar.
Oh, okay. Okay.
So they're still around today. Qatar. So yes, they probably traced the, yeah, well, I thought so too, but it's, I'm reliably informed it is actually Qatar.
So yeah, that's what I've been.
But anyway, let me get to two other points here, and then we can perhaps spring the trap in the third episode here. 1919, yes. The League of Nations formed. This was Woodrow Wilson's great dream. It of course failed. The United States never signed on to the League of Nations. But the League of Nations Charter in June of 1919, Article 22, created a mandate, gave Britain control over what is now Palestine. Or what became Palestine, I should say, which at the time included everything that is now Jordan. So everything that is now Israel and Jordan was under British control. That went into effect in 1923. At the time of this charter's signing in June of 1919, the Jews were promised everything that is now Israel and Jordan.
Oh, okay.
So everything east and west of the Jordan River was to be Israel. The whole modern nation of Jordan would have been one greater Israel, but by 1922, when the League of Nations actually convened and the charter went into effect, the mandate, the British mandate, the Jews were told, no, no, you only get what's west of the Jordan River. The rest of it goes to the Arabs. So what had been promised in 1920 by 1922 was reduced by 77%.
Wow.
Then came the 1930s and the discovery of oil, 1930 in Kuwait and Bahrain. And then Arabia, very shortly thereafter, discovered oil. And suddenly the whole dynamic changed because the Western oil men, British Petroleum in the United States, Standard Oil of California, SoCal, Standard Oil of New Jersey, Texaco, they all realized there was a lot of money to be made by partnering up with the Arabs. Now, by this point, Jack Philby, who I mentioned earlier, Philby of Arabia, had gone native. He had served for a while as Britain's top MI6 officer based in Amman, Jordan. So he was responsible for everything in what is now Jordan and Israel. He created an army for the country of Transjordan, now Jordan, called the Arab Legion. This was trained and armed by the government of Great Britain. He also began forming Arab militias. This was back in the 1920s. And training them in terrorist tactics that they would then employ against Jewish settlers who were coming to Palestine, believing in the promise of the British government that, yes, you will have a home in Palestine. They were emigrating, while at the same time, their top intelligence officer in the region was training Arabs to commit acts of terrorism. The Jews finally responded in 1936, an organization called the Irgun, which was a Jewish terrorist organization, then another one called the Stern Gang that began responding in kind. So it was like when you get into the settlement of the Ohio River Valley, for example, after the American Revolution, did the Indians start committing acts of terror against the settlers, or were the settlers committing acts of terror against the Indians? The answer is yes.
Right.
So... but funny again, it appears that it began in the early 1920s with a rogue MI6 agent who had a grudge against the British government and who, I guess I should have mentioned straight right at the start, Philby really hated the Jews. He'd gone native. After 1925, Ibn Saud pointed out to him that if he converted to Islam, he could have four wives. And so Philby did. At the age of 45, he converted to Islam, was circumcised, which is bad enough when you're a boy 8 days old. When you're 45 years old and a grown man, it is a really painful procedure.
And you're going to remember.
But he did it.
You don't remember 8 days old.
Right.
Exactly. This is a level of commitment that is way beyond anything I would agree to, but that's how committed Philby was. And Philby, through his connections in the intelligence game, we'll talk about this in the next segment, because he made some connections to American intelligence and to oil men in the United States that helped make Ibn Saud very wealthy, helped finance the militia units and the armies that were aligned against the creation of an independent Jewish state, and also helped supply the oil and petrol needed by Hitler's war machine during World War II. All of this with the aid and assistance of not just Philby and rogue elements inside MI6, but rogue elements inside the OSS, American intelligence, the precursor to the CIA. We've heard about some of the bankers and industrialists who made money with Hitler. The oil men did too, and we'll talk about that and how that led to the creation of Israel.
Wow!
In the next program.
Okay. Well, we are going to have you back for the next show. We're out of time for today.
Sorry, you guys are going to have to wait for a couple days for the next show, but it's going to be exciting. I suggest you stick around.
Yeah, David, go ahead and you can kind of set it up, and I'll turn it over to you.
Again, we are talking with Derek Gilbert, Gilbert House Ministries, and host of 5 in 10 on Skywatch. Again, the second smartest person in the world, because his wife's smarter than him. You're going to love Sharon when you see it. But listen, this is the end of this one. If you haven't received Jesus Christ, do it today, because Lord willing, we will be back with the rest of this story on our next show. So again, you can find all our videos, lastchristian.net, lastchristian.net, and we will see you in the next show. You guys have a blessed day. Bye-bye.
Thanks again for joining us today for The Last Christian Radio Show. And be sure to tune in every Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday right here and at www.lastchristian.net. Until the trumpet sounds.
Some people won't give you the real talk on drugs, but it's time we know the facts. Fentanyl is killing people. It's a powerful opioid, often made illegally and commonly mixed with illicit drugs. It can even be pressed into counterfeit pills that resemble prescription medications. Just 2 milligrams, about the size of a few grains of sand, could potentially be lethal. This isn't an ad to scare you, but it is an ad to make you think twice. Get the facts. Go to realdealonfentanyl.com. This message is brought to you by the Ad Council.